Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network.
And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, we'll go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score which would bring victory to 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History, and it's my Mobilia, the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network, in conjunction with Slick Enterprises. We're live from the Southport, North Carolina home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Slick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history of memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia, and you can find us on the web at gridirongreatsmagazine.com. It is at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host, the senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Larger. The head from Portland, Oregon, Mr. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to the show this evening.
Bob, happy to be back. Seems like it's been a couple weeks. I don't really track when we do shows, but it's just it's like talking to an old friend. You pick up the phone, you're like, oh, my gosh, it seems like it's been forever.
It's been a few weeks, and yeah. Both of our schedules have been pretty much jammed up one way or the other. So we're back, and we're going to have quite a few shows this month. And I know you're venturing out for a travel trip, and hopefully I'll have Jeff back in, Jeff Payne as a guest co-host, and a couple other possibilities as far as guests are concerned, so we'll keep everybody posted as we go along. Anyways, let's get started, and I'll hand off to you first.
As I've mentioned before, Christmas come early. The latest volume 22, number 81 of Gridiron Greats was in my mailbox. The old Swick Enterprise innocuous white envelope that we've all grown to love. And a great, man, a packed on, magazine this go around. I mean, I was just looking, I started reading it, and I generally start off with your, editor's page, which I always really enjoy. Just your insight. This one is written before the National, which we'll talk about. But just listen to this. I mean, the content. If you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats, what the hell are you waiting for? I mean, that's more true to form than in this episode than any. Martin Jacobs talking about Bud Grant, Harv Aronson talking about Terry Bradshaw. A really good article about the home of the birthplace of professional football. Behind the Table, another one from John Spano. Green Bay Packer, Scott Klein, coming in Super Collector before. I believe we've had him on the show. Ken Riley, Jared Krause, Slaying the Mainstream Monster, which is a really, really good article by Jeff Payne. Loved that one. Pro Set, and you know, talking about the Pro Set, Gridiron Grill, my article I was talking about. And I wanted to focus on the cover. The cover is obviously the if you haven't gotten it yet, it has nine cards adorning the 1989 Pro Set. It's got Mike Ditka, the back of the John Elway card, the Bo Jackson card, the Montana card, Bradshaw, Barry Sanders, Dan Fouts, the Lombardi Trophy, and then William Perry. It, as I'm looking at this, I love that set. It's a good-looking set. I love the green and red borders, et cetera. And the first thing I noticed was that there is no Steve Largent card from the 89 Pro Set on the cover, Bob. How does something like this slip by the so-called, I'm using air quotes here, publishers of Gridiron Greats? And I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to give Bob some latitude here. Bo Jackson, John Elway, Joe Montana, Barry Sanders, Dan Fouts, Terry Bradshaw, the Lombardi Trophy in the middle. And I'm like, that's chocked full of Hall of Famers. That's a good skew of people. And then I'm like, well, hold on. All right. Mike Ditka and William the Refrigerator Perry. Kind of a weird choice to go over Steve Largent's 89 Pro Set, which is a really good-looking card. I'm like, all right. Well, Ditka, obviously coach, Hall of Fame, or not Hall of Fame, but the Super Bowl winner, 85 Bears, one of the best teams ever, defensive team. I'm one of the better coaches. So, okay, William the Refrigerator Perry. When did he go into the Hall of Fame, Bob?
Well,
when did he retire from the league?
To try to give our listeners some background, when we designed the cover, Jared and I spend a lot of time talking about what we want to do. Right. And this cover basically was a tip of the hat to the Chicago Bear crowd, who we saw a lot of at the National. And I figured Perry is a folk hero in Chicago, any way you want to look at
Absolutely.
It. He's never forgotten. Ditka is Ditka. A lot of people say I look like him, which I really don't, but I guess I do in a way. And I wanted to lead off with a couple Bears in that mix. And we did, and honestly, Jared and I did mention the Largent factor. And I had final veto over it, and I basically vetoed it because I wanted to get Perry in and I wanted to get Dicta in. So, and I knew I was going to get feedback from you one way or the other. So, but I had to make an executive decision, because of the crowd and because of the, I don't know what their attendance was, a couple million people, I guess, whatever it came up to be. We went more with the Chicago slant than we did with the Seahawks
gotcha.
Slant and enlarge it. And hold that thought, because as I give my review, I got to mention something to you, which just popped in my head about the convention. But anyways, that's why your man was not in the front cover.
Let's get back to the review of this Gridiron Greats. I'll text Jared a little later and admonish him for not reminding you of the importance of a Largent card in there. Jeff Payne's article, I love it when he broke down by set name how many cards he was after. I mean, it was a really interesting way to look at it. It was just kind of cool. The Chickles, the Sports King, it was just it was such an interesting way. And I knew that was a monster, and he calls it the monster. And it was kind of cool. And I've heard we've had Jeff on the show as both a guest and a co-host, and I think we know his story about collecting quite a bit. It was also really cool, his Q&A in the back, where he talks about how he got back into it, completing it, going after big cards, the Mayos, the, et cetera. It was kind of cool. It was just a little bit, shined a light a little bit more on, you know, how people collect, how they go about tackling something like this. I really enjoyed that article.
And I think his article really expressed to me something I went through, you know, over a period of roughly, you know, what amounted to being 40 plus years of putting together my run actively, not knowing that I was creating a run back in the 60s and 70s when I was buying packs. But, you know, I really enjoyed his story because a lot of it was very familiar to me. Obviously, my run does not, you know, has some similarities to his run, but mine, again, focuses just, you know, the mainstream 48 to 88, and then 89 up, I just did the tops run for 2015. But you're right. I mean, it did bring to light everybody's collecting story is very different. And can you imagine how difficult it is today if you want to build that run or my run in raw condition? And that's the part that scares me now. You know what I mean? So, but again, his story was very similar to a lot of other people's stories. Obviously not to that degree, but, you know, somebody said I put together all the top card sets from 1960 to 1989 or whatever it may have been. You'd share a lot of those similar experiences. You know what I mean?
Yep. Yep. And back on page 44, publisher Bob Swick reviews Bears versus Cardinals by Joe Ziemba, who we had on the show. That's the book I started reading. Really, really good book, and I loved your review of it, Bob. I finished that up from the last time we had him on the show, and it just I learned a lot about, Halas and just that relationship between Halas and the other owners and Halas and the players. I mean, it was a really, really good book. I mean, even the Mafia, like you mentioned in your review.
It was an excellent book. I really enjoyed it, and Joe did a great job on it. I'm very thankful we had him on the show to talk about it. And again, excellent history of early Chicago football, excellent history of the Cardinals themselves. Great, just a great book all around.
But Behind the Table by John Spano, something I always enjoy. As a buyer, I've never set up at the show other than, kind of watching the table while, you know, you run to get something to eat or something. I've had fun, you know, manning that table with you, but it's really cool to just his insight and just, what people are thinking. Yeah, you know what I mean? Just the dealer mentality. It's kind of cool. I enjoy those articles.
Right.
What is that, his second or third that he's written?
I think it's the third. I think it's the third. I got to double check because he had the one on. I think it's the third one. I'll have to double check off the top of my head. But it was a good issue for the National, and it was a good issue. That was featured, believe it or not, at the Professional Football Researchers Association in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where all the attendees who went to that convention did receive their own copy of Gridiron Greats magazine. And I know several of them are subscribers already, but they did. I already heard back from several people from the convention who have signed up as new subscribers. They enjoyed the magazine. So that was good. I want to spend a little time talking about the National because, again, this is probably, my 14th or 15th National that I've actually set up at or, you know, with other guys, so on and so forth. And by far and wide, I will just lead off by saying I have never seen more people in my life at a National. I have never seen more tables at a National. You know how the convention hall is there. Every conceivable room in that convention hall was open and had tables in it. to the extent that apparently there was about 600,000 square feet of tables there at the show. And there were all sorts of separate rooms that I never saw. I didn't even know existed there that were open with tables of vendors, corporate sponsors, and the ultimate box-breaking tables, which are very, very prevalent today at a show and more so at the National. And I said this several times during the show, I'm still a dinosaur in the hobby, but I really have never seen anything like I saw this past show in the sheer volume of people, people going through the show. All the constant statement I heard from a lot of people that actually swung by to my table was, this is way too overwhelming for me. I don't know where to go first. I don't know what to do. I've never experienced anything like this. And then I heard from the people who were only there one day, I am not going to be able to get through one third of the show with a one-day pass, let alone see everything that I want to see here. So it was, you know, to me in a way, it was great for the hobby in a way, but at the same time, I really wonder how many people might have been disappointed when they got there and they're saying, hey, I didn't even know where to go first. And I suggested to a couple of collectors there who did stop by the table, I said, just try to get to the vendors if you're looking to buy merchandise. Don't worry about the box-breaking people. Don't worry about the Panini and the Fanatics and those people. You know, try to just get to the tables where you're looking for cards or magazines or programs or whatever you're looking for.
Totally.
And try to pick up what you're looking for there. So, but again, I kiddingly stated, I think next year I'm just going to have backpacks and card-carrying cases for sale. I think I'll do much better, by selling those rather than anything related to sports.
Interesting. How'd you do for new subscribers to Gridiron Greats? I mean,
I wait a 30-day period. We really pushed out a lot of copies at the show. Besides myself, the Gridiron Greats subscriber collector's connection was handing them out at his booths with his new people who were signing up for his mailing list and so on and so forth. So I came home with no extra copies. I basically gave out all the copies I brought with me, which was close to 300. And I know Scott at Collector's Connection gave out all the ones he had. So we really pushed out a ton of copies, much more than normal at a National. Because, again, I'm not going to give them to a hockey collector, a basketball collector, so on and so forth. I'm focusing on people, obviously, who collect football. And there are people who are very nice to me and say, listen, I only collect hockey, I only collect basketball, whatever. I'm not interested. That's fine. I appreciate them saying it. But for the people, you know, I could tell, you know, I had a gut feeling, you know, you got a football jersey on or whatever. You know, those are the people I focused on. So we gave out a lot.
Yeah.
And it takes me 30 days to read how many new subscribers we got. I was pleasantly surprised from the PFRA convention, already hearing back from a few people who wanted to subscribe, so on and so forth. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. It was a much more active crowd than in Atlantic City last year. This year was much more active. It was much more of a buying crowd. And, I hate to say it, but there is a strong element of the hobby now that is just totally graded material. And it's all basketball graded, and you're not going to change, you're not going to shake it until the bubble hits on the new stuff, and individuals get either get burnt by buying a $1,000 card that's now only worth $100, and or getting burnt by a superstar player never stepped on the court, ends up being a big bust and they lost all their money on their card type of thing. So that, I think, is still ready to happen at some point. I don't know when or where or how. But at the same time, I think the market for vintage is red hot. especially for graded vintage. But there was still a good element of guys out there trying to find raw material to finish their sets, so on and so forth. And the one thing that really surprised me was how many people were looking for oddball football. And I insert an oddball football. And I did have some, and I had a bunch of guys email me. I told them, just send me your want list, and I'll go through it here at home, because I did not bring, I brought maybe 20% of what I had as far as oddball is concerned. I could have, there's no way I could take everything type of situation. So I thought that market is starting to look very, very good again, which I think is good for the football collecting hobby.
Yeah. Now, in our football text thread, a lot of people had mentioned, people walking around with, otter cases and stuff like that, that, just are filled with their modern shiny stuff that they were trying to sell and or trade for. Yeah, so. I completely agree with you. It seems like that is what is popular until it becomes unpopular. The bottom falling out of that market.
Yeah, I think at some point it's going to correct itself, and it's going to be a pretty major correction. Because again, I'm a dinosaur. I'm shocked seeing probably a guy in his early 20s. Open up his backpack and take out $10,000 cash and start counting it out. You know what I mean? It just blows my mind to see this kind of stuff. So I'm seeing it with my own eyes. I'm seeing it again like I saw it in Atlantic City. I just find it amazing. So is it good or bad for the hobby? Well, many dealers love it because they're making money off of it. And other dealers are a little more cautious by saying, that might be a little too great speculation taking place in the market, and it might not be good in the long run. But again, over the past 20 years, actually 30 years now, there have been so many bubbles in the card market, it's not even funny. So to me, there's just going to be another bubble that's going to happen, and, the hobby will survive from it and just go from there to the next one. My bigger concern right now is Fanatics buying up everything. I don't necessarily think that's the greatest thing for the hobby right now. They're talking about, and I heard a lot of, not rumblings, but talk about they're going to start their own shows. I think they're going to gear it more, they're going to probably gear it more toward the box break crowd and or the younger crowd, the graded crowd. Rather than vintage collectors like you and I. And that's fine, but like a couple of longtime collectors who I talked to said, they feel more comfortable in the smaller regional show trying to find stuff than they are now at the National, because the National has just become way too big for them to even navigate. And you got to be there 5 days to try to get around and see everything. That's the reality of the situation. I never made it to set up on Wednesday because of all the flight issues I had there. So I basically had to pack it in on Wednesday. So I didn't set up until Thursday. So I was only there Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and I came home on Sunday. And I guess I heard on Sunday it was a pretty big crowd again. So it's interesting. I stayed in Atlantic City last year on Sunday. It was better than a doornail. This time I come home and it was busier than anything. So, but I had a good time the 3 days. And again, for me now, it's more seeing people I haven't seen all year, talking to them and getting caught up.
Yep.
And that's the fun of the show for me now. Separate from any material or any subscriptions or anything like that. So it was pretty interesting. Now, You're gonna mention a few things about REA Auctions. I had the pleasure of talking to Brian Dwyer, who owns REA Auctions, at the show, actually before the show on 2 days, and fill us in on what you saw there.
Well, they did a really good job. They opened their auction like the day of the National starting out. Right. And there's some really good football in there. Joe Montana, rookie 10, some good unopened. 65 tops, tall boy, wax pack, sealed by GAI. Not sure how good it looks. It's got a tear in the wrapper and the back flap looks a little open, but tremendous amount of unopened from 78, 79, 81, 84, 87. I mean, just really good stuff. Just another good, good auction with some good football in there. They're doing a really good job with their, you know, they used to do one big auction. And when Brian bought it, he started going to, two and then four. Now, now he runs small ones. He's got the quarterly ones that are large and then the small ones that are kind of eBay-esque in between. It's just good to see them joining that fray. Just another good auction. I think Brian is such a classy operator of REA. He does a great job. We've been lucky to have quite a few auction house owners on our show.
He definitely is light years ahead of his competitors, in my opinion. He does a great job with the auction. And I was glad to I actually got some time to talk to him before the show and get filled in on some hobby happenings and so on and so forth. So that was very interesting. But that's going to be a good auction one way or the other. You know, the other comment I got to make is, at one time there was only a handful of the big auction houses in the market. Now there's so many different auction houses. You're on overload in a lot of cases, just trying to check out who has what, what auctions so on and so forth. And in a way, I kind of miss the, twice a year big auction. You're going to see some premier stuff. You look forward to it, so on and so forth. And some people could have real auction burnout and, just not have the funds to try to keep up with everything. And, for the sake of just bidding on something that may not fit their collection or whatever, they bid on it and then what's the word I'm trying to use? They have regret. Another auction comes up where there's something they really need in it, and then the funds are not available, whatever the case might be. So it's pretty much a very, very overwhelming amount of material in the market.
Yeah.
And it's there's so much stuff out there. It just amazes me. It seems like every attic in America has been emptied of sports memorabilia, and it's out there. One way or the other, so it just boggles my mind sometimes looking at it and seeing that. And again, if you had gone to this show, Joe, I think you would have just been amazed to see what a difference it was since the last Chicago National you were at. Truly, truly different vibe, and just an enormous amount of people. An enormous amount of people. They also had some sort of trade night there. And apparently, I guess, the younger set up with their cases and their graded cards.
Huh.
And I heard that was pretty successful when people were trading their stuff, so on and so forth. So, but again, I was inundated. Do you buy? You want to trade? You want to buy? And I should have just put up a sign. I do not deal with graded cards. And that would have saved a lot of people the time just even asking me about the stuff. So
it's set up with, no, I don't have any modern stuff.
Yeah, I don't have any modern stuff, and no, I don't have any graded cards. So it is what it is. I'm actually doing the show Saturday and Sunday in Wilmington, North Carolina here, my normal show that I do. So it should be interesting. Even though they're back-to-back, the gentleman who's putting the show on has been asked numerous times to run the Wilmington show on a Sunday because a lot of guys work on Saturday. They can't get to the show. So it should be interesting to see what kind of crowds we get on Saturday and Sunday. So he runs a nice little show, and he told me already sold out. There's 67 tables of dealers there, so it's going to be packed. I mean, I know the hall. It's a big American Legion hall. In Wilmington, downtown Wilmington, and man, it's going to be a lot of people there. I can sense it already. So I got a lot of stuff that's going to be going into the Rav over on Friday night, yep. And I'll be up there. So we'll see what happens. Yep.
And I am hoping no weddings get in my way. No, yeah, my wife and I just hooked up too many trips this year, and we had a wedding to go to and sisters on Friday, the day of the auction. Yeah, just a tough one. Next year in Cleveland, the year after that in Atlantic City. Cleveland's okay. I found that to be a good venue. Hotels were pretty far apart, pretty far away from the convention center. I mean, it's almost better to rent a car and be able, because you and I remember we had a dinner with a bunch of football collectors and, the BST boys. I mean, it was a 30-minute, Uber ride out there when we shared it. It was,
right.
That was the closest dinner place. I liked Cleveland. I mean, I have to say Baltimore was probably my favorite national, but we all know it probably won't go back there just because of, financials. Oh, well.
Right. Yeah, Baltimore will never happen. I'm wondering what they ended up voting on, because it's going to be either Chicago all 3 years after next year, Chicago, Atlantic City, Chicago, or Chicago, Atlanta, Chicago. And I heard some not great reviews of Atlanta, because of where it's located, and again, it's going to be another situation. I don't think they have the room, to be honest with you, to handle everything. Atlantic City made the bid that they will give $1,000 dealer credit of some sort if they have it in Atlantic City. That'll be interesting to see if that pans through. My gut feeling, they voted, and they probably voted for to keep it in Chicago every year. And if that's the case, that's the case. That's it. I mean, to me, it's way, way, way big. And people are going to, if they're going to go, they're going to have to really plan how they're going to go and how many days they're going to spend and have a better plan of action of what they're going to look at, so on and so forth, so they're not disappointed. But again, reading all the articles about it, I mean, it was all, wine and roses there for everybody, and this the greatest show ever occurring. But I've been to some good nationals in my time. I've been to good some great regional shows in my time, and every show has its good points and has some negative points, and that's it. So I still like Baltimore. Baltimore, the two nationals there were great. Nice location. Easy to get around downtown, plenty of places to eat, plenty of hotels right around the convention center. Atlantic City, to me, this was my, I think it was my second or third. I know I didn't set up the first time I was in Atlantic City, I never set up there. I think I did go for the day. And then I set up at the last two. To me, logistically, it's just a pain in the neck to set up there, and it's a rough place to do business, so it's not conducive to me being hobby growth. Chicago. Yeah. I did like Cleveland, with the exception, like you said, last time I did Cleveland, I stayed downtown Cleveland and had to have a Uber ride every day to get in, so that was an additional expense. But I learned my lesson the first time. I stayed near the convention center at a small hotel, and there was absolutely nothing around me. There were no restaurants or anything like that. So that becomes difficult to deal with also. So this time in Cleveland, if I go, I'm probably going to drive, and B, I'm going to still stay downtown Cleveland because there's much, more restaurants, more activity, so on and so forth. So
yeah, we heard Al Crisafulli with Love of the Game was on the show. He talked about how rotating it around frequently or going to new places. Like he said, when the Atlantic City show was one of the best he ever had, because it had been 20 years since the show had been in AC. The dealers are there for consignments to walk in the door. And he's like, if no one's seen a show and you think you have some valuable cards, and you haven't seen a show in 20 years, and then you walk in and you have a chance to sell your personal collection, your PC. He mentioned, like I said, AC was one of the biggest, best shows he's had. Chicago is there so often. he mentioned, you know, it's saturated. The market's saturated there. Anybody who's had a collection to sell has already been into the National and probably already sold it. So Atlanta would probably be a really good show for dealers, consignment-wise.
Right, right. But again, then you get the argument that dealers are there to sell. They have a tough time selling because everybody's trying to sell their collections. So, you know, it sometimes works in the opposite way. That's why I still like regional shows like Chantilly. There's a big show in Raleigh here in North Carolina, which I'm going to attend and think about setting up. I set up in a show in South Carolina last year, a real small hotel show. Actually, one of our subscribers puts it on, and I went there. But for me, logistically, I got to stay overnight. You know, it's a 10-hour round trip for me. I'm not excited about that anymore. You know what I mean? So unless it's a 2-3-day event type of thing, it's not really worth it for me to do those types of shows. Those days are over for me as far as wanting to do something like that. So it's interesting to see all the different shows. And I do make the comment on Nashville has that big show now, and they're calling it the Southern National. I definitely have to get there to see what's going on there, because I've heard all sorts of stuff on how nice that show is, and a lot of dealers, a lot of individuals, you know, a lot of great memorabilia you really don't see at other shows. So that's something that has to be taken into consideration too.
What I find incredibly cool city too.
What I just find amazing to me, New England, Connecticut, Massachusetts. I've done shows in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, and New York, and the vibe up there is just so dramatically different than the vibe down here. As far as collectors being much more patient, not so aggressive as far as trying to negotiate with you. You know, the simple please and thank yous that I hear down here are just very, very interesting to me compared to New England shows. So it's a definite,
say that again.
Definite.
You're saying people in the South are a lot more. Say that again. Clarify that.
So basically, the people in the South here are much more pleasant at a show.
Yeah.
They're much more polite, and they're not as hard pressed to, you know, you have a card for $100. I'm only going to give you $50. That's it. And, you know, that type of situation. So it's interesting to see how different parts of the country act at a show. Like Dispatch National, I really didn't have any run-ins with anybody per se as far as, you know, what I had to offer, you know, what I was selling it for, so on and so forth. You know, I gave fair pricing. You know, people who bought from me were pleased, so on and so forth, type of thing. But, do a couple of shows in Connecticut and or New York, and you get that, you know, that beat-up mentality almost of, you know, I got to come out, meaning the customer has to come out victorious with what they're paying for, or whatever the case may be. So it's very different, very different. It's a nice change of pace for me.
Cleveland next year, which I will be at, and I'll look forward to. Like I said, I'll probably rent a car with a big back seat. My son Xander was asking about it. He'll be 15 and a half. We go to that. He's starting to become one of the usuals at our you know, VFC dinners. And then Atlantic City after that. I didn't hear good things. I'll probably skip that, sadly. You know, it is what it is.
Oh, so they did vote. They did because I haven't heard anything. It should be Cleveland, then Chicago, and then it's going to be Atlantic City, Chicago. You're looking at it now?
No, I'm not. I was just going off of what I was told.
Okay.
It was Cleveland, AC, and then it was going to be Chicago from pretty much that point out. I don't think dealers will like that. Just because what I heard from Al and a couple other dealers, where they said, you know, the you know, the consignments walking in the door become saturated if you have it too many times in a row like that.
Right. So, well, that'll be interesting.
The dealers that pay to set up. So,
Exactly.
We shall see. So, Aria is good auction items. Like I said, some good wax, which I've been really getting into, including a box of 74, which is pretty cool. Huggins and Scott ends tonight. Not a huge football selection. Heritage is coming up in 2 weeks. And included in there are two Seattle Seahawks Super Bowl rings. One is to an office person, and the other one is from a player that they didn't mention. And that's the first time I've seen them say this is from a player, but that player wants to be anonymous. And I always thought they put the players' names on the rings, but I zoomed in on that one and didn't have the name.
I thought so, too. And again, I don't know. I don't know how they're going to protect it one way or the other because, the ring collectors are pretty narrow one way or the other as far as what they, who they're collecting and so on and so forth. So the big question is, are you going to go after it?
You said ring collectors are pretty narrow, and that narrow gap has me on the outside looking in. I do not collect rings, even the full Super Bowl rings are my favorite team. But check this out, Captain. The 2013 Seattle Seahawks Super Bowl ring by a player is right now at $17,000, which is $20,400, including the VIG. The one for the office
I believe it.
Is at $12,500, which is $15,000. So about a 30% premium for a player ring versus an advocate ring, which is pretty interesting.
Right. I would say that's pretty much about right. You got that kind of gap, knowing it's not a player, knowing it's just a office person type of thing. But anyways...
But I don't know if these rings are so thinly traded. I would imagine there's not a lot of people who collect them. Have we ever had a ring collector on the show? I think so. I mean,
Michael Borkin years ago when he was an active collector, and he wrote for Gridiron Greats. And from what I heard, he got completely out of the hobby. So, I don't know really any other ring collectors, to be honest with you. And I never really took a liking to them either. So I don't wear jewelry per se. So I don't, I'm not big on a ring one way or the other. It really doesn't do anything for me. Quick story, though.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, quick story that popped in my mind. It popped in my head. We're talking about Seahawks stuff. There were two guys walking down the aisle at the show. They both had large jerseys on, and I kind of waved them down as best as I could. And one guy was from the Seattle, Washington area, and then the other guy used to live there, and he was basically in Illinois now. But they both said they still like the Seahawks. I mentioned your name. They didn't know you. But anyways, they said they are Largent fans, and they are Seattle Seahawks fans. So I said, well, that's very interesting, because those are probably the only two guys I saw out of 100,000 people that had Seattle Seahawks jerseys on. I did see a variety of teams that are represented, but those were the only two Seahawk guys, larger guys in the convention center. So, all right, go ahead.
I was just going to say, also in that Heritage auction are two of your favorite cards, the 2000 playoff contender Tom Brady rookie ticket autograph card.
Yep.
Say that three times fast, which is the non-golden ticket version, so it's the less expensive version. But there's a BGS 8 that's at 6,500 right now, and another one. Hang on, look at, I zoomed in on it on accident. And then another one that's also a non-autograph one, right? That's a 8.5 for 10,000. So now's your time, Bob. 2 weeks to go.
Wow.
An 8.5 with a 10 autograph. Tom Brady's autograph is literally illegible. I mean, if you put 10 autographs in, you would never get it. And what a subjective thing to grade is his autograph, because it just looks like crap to begin with. Oh, well. None of my business. I don't collect autographs. But,
I think with Brady, in Brady's case, he's signed so much stuff over the years. He really has nothing that, to me, is rare in any way, shape, or form. So you really got to like Brady, and or you got to have pretty big pockets to put out money, you know, for those types of autograph cards.
Good point.
Which still are in demand, obviously. But at the same time, I don't really see, you know, them appreciating any more than what they are now. You know what I mean? So it'll be interesting to see where his stuff plays out down the road. And he's going to be that much in demand in the future. So we'll see what happens one way or the other with that.
Generally, I mean, I remember being, made a guy an offer for his 2000 SB rookie card right before that undefeated Super Bowl. And his stock was rising. And I decided to wait till after the Super Bowl. Would he have an 18-0 record, or would he, you know, lose the show? And I just remember he lost the show, and the card went from, you know, a $4,000 card to a $3,000 card because, you know, just that, you know, just, you know, that prestige was off. Is there another bump in value? Tom Brady's obviously a first ballot Hall of Fame. He's up there in that pantheon with, you know, Jim Brown, Jerry Rice, you know, Joe Montana, Steve Largent, you know, just first round Hall of Famer. And yes, I did just slip in Steve Largent in that pantheon. I wouldn't be me if I didn't. So, I mean, it's not like there's a huge mystery shrouded around will he make it, will he not? I mean, you know, so I think any Hall of Fame bump has already been established. You know what I mean? So you might be right. There might be nowhere to go but down for his card value.
He can be hyped all he wants, but at the same time, at some point, the market is not going to, you know, continue to absorb $100,000, $200,000 worth of Brady material, you know, every month.
Good point.
Type of thing. I think at some point...
Yep.
They're going to move on to the next hot player, so on and so forth. And if Mahomes has a good season this year, I think his rookie is going to skyrocket again, especially if they go to the Super Bowl again. So it'll be interesting to see what actually will happen down the road, with Brady cards and so on and so forth. So it'll be interesting to see. I saw a nice Brady Bucks jersey autographed in a frame. But again, you know, you got to be a Brady fan and or a Bucks fan to enjoy it.
And, totally.
You know, got to spend a pretty penny to buy this one. So
totally.
This is what it is.
No, they're expensive. I will hopefully, you know, the house fire we had 18 months ago, hopefully our house will be done by Christmas, or, you know, about mid-December is what we're being told. But now I feel a little scattered. I have some of my collections here at the house we're renting. I have some of my collections at my office in a concrete vault we have there, and I have some of them in a storage, you know, area that we have, you know, our storage place we have in a building. And I don't know. And I feel so disorganized with my collection right now. And when you were talking about moving and you're like, man, just the art of packing up is enough for you to vet out certain things. And then the art of unpacking and organizing is another, you know, swing at the bat, you know, for organizing and getting rid of stuff. And I get the feeling, you know, like I was working on set runs for a while, ungraded set runs in binders and stuff like that. And I really enjoyed organizing those. I think that moment has passed. I hate to say it. I think I'm going to sell those. It's, I don't know. It's,
well, it's a progression of any collector to move into different things. And I think, you know, getting back to what you said, I'm still not technically unpacked. I still have two buckets. I still want to, I got to pick out another bookcase or whatever. But at the same time, I continue to go through what I have. And, you know, when I unpacked everything, I was just so pleased to see some of the stuff I forgot about.
Yeah.
And then I have to make a determination of what I really want to keep and what I don't want to keep, since, you know, I'm not going to pass this down to anybody in the family because nobody wants it. So at some point, I know I have to start getting rid of stuff. And I did get rid of a lot of stuff when I moved, believe it or not, but that was more inventory than anything else. So this will be interesting to see, you know, what I continue to go through and what I can offer for sale and or trade type of thing. And I tell everybody kiddingly, the last thing that'll ever go on me is my run of football cards from 48 to 2015. That set of binders that I look at in this man cave is, or I call it man loft since I'm upstairs, is the last thing that's going to go of my collection, because that's still my baby. That's still the thing I get the greatest enjoyment looking at. And if I had to get rid of everything, I would keep that as the last stuff, you know what I mean? So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But I do understand where you're coming from, especially if you got stuff in three different locations and you can't access things. And I think that's the one thing I had a lot of difficulty when I was moving. My collection was pretty much packed up in storage for almost 6 months. So it was quite a while.
Yeah.
You know, and
while your house is being completed, yeah.
So when everything came into the house, you know, after we got the main stuff done, I started working on unpacking my stuff, and it was nice. It was very, very nice. And the first thing I did was unpack the run, all the binders, make sure they were okay, and I really didn't have any damage to anything because I really packaged them well, and then started. Second thing I unpacked were all my Packer stuff. So pretty interesting what you go through, especially with a move and or if you're going to downsize or anything like that.
Yep.
So in your
case,
you sent
a picture of your book.
I definitely sympathize
with
what you're going through.
It was awesome. we did reclaim quite a bit. Our house was like built in 1907. So we had a lot of old ductwork in the basement that had been softened around. So there were spots in the basement where it's, you know, like, you know, 6 foot four. But normally the basement's about, you know, eight and a half feet tall. So we did take this opportunity to, you know, get rid of that ductwork, put in a furnace on our third floor, and then just basically, I call it reclaiming the basement. And then Stacy allowed me to kind of man cave it. So it's, I've got, you know, tall ceilings, TV down there, a couch area. And there's a spot where we had to soften a wall out to hide some plumbing lines. And it created a nice little picture alcove. And I'm like, I point to the, you know, the guy doing the restoration, like, that would be a perfect spot for a framed Steve Largent jersey with a light on it. And everybody's
cool.
Like, oh, yes, perfect. So I have this little alcove that's about 10 inches deep, perfect frame size, that will be my my illuminated Largent jersey. You know, spot. So I'm kind of looking forward to that. It is fun.
That sounds great. That sounds perfect for you.
Yep, I'm pretty stoked. Oh, well. You know, it's okay. I mean, as I mentioned, everybody was safe from a fire. It's a good chance to just kind of repack, you know, and go through. But
right.
I do feel a little weird how many times I feel like I've, you know, quote-unquote reinvented my collection from, you know, wax and, you know, runs and Hall of Fame rookie cards to getting rid of my wax and now back to my wax. There's been a couple times where I've been like, oh, man, maybe I should go back to Hall of Fame rookie, but it's a lot different now. You know, the prices are a lot higher.
Yeah.
I couldn't afford a Nagurski again, you know.
Well, I think what you have focused on, you have really, to me, basically four separate collections. You got your pack collection, you got your uncut sheet collection, you got your large ink collection, and you got your pre-war collection, you know, between Grange, Snag, and, you know, a few other players. So you got a lot of nice stuff. I mean, you know, and they're all historically significant, in my opinion. So it's a nice thing. And, you know, it's interesting when I compare, you know, people say, and again, I go back to my run because I spent the most time on it. I had the most fun with it, and I still like looking at it type of thing. And I know I got a lot of cards I need to upgrade, but I'm not overly concerned whether I upgrade them or not. You know, if I come upon them, I'll upgrade, and if not, it's no big deal with me, you know? So, and I got a lot of Packer stuff. I also have a lot of, you know, you talk about frame stuff. My Manloft now, I got a lot of stuff on the wall. I got a lot of my autographed Packer stuff hanging on the wall now, so it's nice to view it again and see it. You know, I got a lot of 8x10s. I got a lot of stuff geared, drew, and was signed by, for example, Kramer, Forrest Gregg, Marv Fleming. I got several Kramer autographs. I got Bob Saransky, several autographs from him. So it's nice to see it again. So now I can actually look at my stuff. That's the nice thing about it. But I do sympathize with you while you're waiting to get your house finished. It can be very maddening.
Yeah, it's what you went through, like you mentioned. But it'll be put back together. It'll be put back. I used to, just out of my fear of fire from the industry I'm in, I used to keep everything in a safe, and just more and more, everything is out in display. I mean, you've seen the wax pack display case that I bought, you know, that I display everything. I'm really enjoying seeing everything, and, you know, I don't know.
That's the fun of the hobby. I enjoy seeing all my binders. I'm looking at them right now, nice and orderly for a change, and a nice bookshelf, and all my photos at another wall. I got a bunch of Packer pennants on another wall, and I got a couple gridiron grates framed up and looking at them. So, you know, it's nice. And I got a nice bookcase, so I got all my books out. So it's a good thing. It's a nice one. Down to our 2-minute warning again. If you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats, what are you waiting for? Check out our website, gridirongreatsmagazine.com. Also, I just want to mention, if you are looking for back issues, especially some of the early issues, we're pretty much out of several of them. So please contact me first. Via the website, there's a special area you can contact me, and I'll let you know if we have any left. But I know several of the real early issues that we published, I am completely out of them at this time. Joe, handing off to you. What'd you pick up on tonight's show?
Well, you just said something. You said you had a couple Gridiron Greats framed on your wall. All right, you're the publisher of Gridiron Greats. You have access to every single one. Which Gridiron Greats do you have hanging on your wall? What are your favorites?
I have two hanging up. The first issue we ever did was number 23, and I have our 75th copy issue. Those are the two I have hanging up. They're right next to my Green Bay Packers shareholder certificate that is framed. And, I kind of shocked. We just published 81. So as of next issue will be 60 issues that we published. That's a pretty good haul in a 14-year period. So
damn right.
It's pretty interesting. Pretty interesting. We're pretty much out of time. We'll be back at some point, hopefully next week, with another show. Joe, have a great vacation, and we'll be talking soon. Take care. Thanks for listening.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.